Today we have the Government Standards and Practices Commission, Senate Bill 5514. From Legislative Fiscal, we have Steve Bender, and our clerk today is Jamie Penn. Why don't we go ahead and get started, and let's see. Mr. Bender, do you have any information that you can provide us regarding the Government Standards and Practices Commission?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do provide a one-page sheet that you should have that's just labeled Government Standards and Practices Commission, and discusses very briefly and in bullet form some information about their budget and about what this agency does. This is an agency that's almost exclusively a general fund agency. The other funds that they receive are a small amount, about $7,400, that are received for recovering the costs of printing and distributing the documents that they produce. The commission collects fines and forfeitures for violations of the laws that it administers. However, these aren't retained by the agency. They're passed through and transferred to the general fund. The governor's recommended budget for this agency is $705,217 general fund and $7,421 other funds. About 70% of this budget is for personal service costs, about 27% is for services and supplies, and about 2% is for capital outlay for new computers and computer hardware. There's one package above the current service level of $32,200 for upgrading personal computers, networking the computers, establishing email and internet access, and developing an internet website. And at the bottom of this page sheet, instead of focusing on budget issues, I just outline here what it is this agency does. They basically have three areas of the law that they are in charge with enforcing. The first is the Government Standards and Practices Law, which relates to conflict of interest issues. The Oregon Public Meetings Law, which establishes requirements for public meetings and exceptions to those requirements. And they also administer laws regarding the registration and regulation of lotteries. The agency both deals with violations and purported violations of these laws and also acts proactively and has an outreach program where they educate public officials about these particular laws. The other information that I provided is a one-page copy of my IFO analysis of the governor's budget. You've probably seen it in a similar format for every budget that you have. So that is there. And then there's a more detailed analysis of the governor's recommended budget for which you can just see later.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Krupp, should we give Mr. Bender a buy for LFO, using LFO as his acronym for the day?
Mr. Chair, I would fully agree with that. I might make mention for the audience's benefit, if you don't know, and well set of mind in the back row, we have a rule in this committee that you don't use acronyms. You actually say the entire word as it's supposed to be. And if you do use acronyms and you don't correct yourself right away, you put 25 cents per violation in the piggy bank, and that piggy bank goes for a great cause, the American Cancer Society. So sometimes we have great fun, and I think the Secretary of State's office wrote us a check, didn't they?
Yeah, a couple of them. As a matter of fact, you'll see his budget substantially overfunded as a result of that, too. It'll be kind when you come across that. Now, I know that Representative Krupp has guests and visitors here today, but I'd like to introduce Henry O'Keefe. Henry, would you like to stand up? Oh, you are already. Oh, there we go. Okay, Henry. Henry's one of my constituents. He votes early and often. His mother is a county commissioner down in Lake County. She's the chair of the county commission. Jane O'Keefe, a really fine family. They live up in Adele. So. As a matter of fact, you got to drive through a ski resort to get to Henry's house, unless you come in from the back road through Plush. And so it's a great pleasure to have those folks here. Henry Henry enjoys drama. He's 13 years old and gets a lot of time out there with those cows out on the range. So, welcome, Henry. Pelican Lake near there? Is Pelican Lake near there? Okay. Well, you've never seen me throw a rock, obviously. Representative Krupp, would you like to introduce your visitors?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to introduce my lovely wife, who's got me over 4 years, a pretty blonde in the back, and Peggy Sue. Yes, thank you, Buddy Holly. And her uncle, Steve Laughlin, who is a great friend and a small businessman from the city of Lebanon, is up here today observing the workings of the legislature to take home all the great pearls of wisdom that we can provide for him.
Thank you very much, Representative Krupp. Peggy Sue and Mr. Laughlin, we hope that after you've seen how we make sausage at the sausage factory, you'll still be able to eat some. So that's part of the risk that's coming here, I guess. Okay. With the introductions that we've had, let's go ahead and have the folks from the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Let's see, Don, is it Riling? Riling? And let's see. Were you going to bring Department of Administrative Services up with you, Don, first? Is that what your pleasure is? Okay. And Mr. Pat Hearn? Welcome. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. I am Pat Hearn, Executive Director of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. I would like to point out that Mr. Riling is here entirely on his own. His term expired last Tuesday. He presided over his last meeting on Thursday, but because he is a full 4 year served a full four year term, he has some good insight into the operations of the commission. He has been the chair for approximately a year and a half, and I'm very grateful that he was able to be here today. Mr. Chair, Mr. Bender did a very adequate job, I think, of providing you with a brief yet thorough overview of the commission. There's a couple of other things that I'd like to point out very briefly, if I may. I know some of you are familiar with the commission more than others, and yet some of you probably are not. It came into existence as the result of the passage of a referral that was sent to the voters in 1974. Immediately after Watergate. Actually, it was passed in the 1973 session by both houses. When it went to Governor McCall for signature, he vetoed it. He didn't like the statement of economic interest disclosure provision. He likened it to requiring a gentleman to undress in public. So he vetoed the bill. Well, during the interim, the assembly came back in early of January of 1974 to deal with some other matters, and they took the matter up again and then repassed it as a referral. It has some interesting requirements for membership, unlike most governor-appointed boards or commissions in the state. It has 7 members. 4 of the 7 are appointed by the legislative leadership. That is, the Senate Democrats and Republicans and the House Democrats and Republicans each nominate a name for the governor. And then the remaining 3, they are appointed directly by the governor. It can't be more than 4 belonging to either of the 2 major political parties serving on the commission at a given time, and of the 3 that the governor appoints directly, no more than 2 may belong to either of the 2 major political parties. And because of that setup, it's kind of an interesting thing. It's not at all unusual for governors to frequently have to appoint members to this commission that are not of their own party. It happens quite often. The jurisdiction of the commission, Mr. Bender said, relates to conflicts of interest, which is true, and that is the requirement that when financial conflicts of interest arise, they be publicly disclosed. It also prohibits public officials from using their office to obtain financial gain for themselves, for a relative, or for a business that they or a relative is associated with if the opportunity to avail themselves of that benefit exists only by virtue of holding the position or office. There are some other restrictions in the statute, such as a limitation on gifts, with some exceptions. Second area of jurisdiction is Mr. Bender indicated his public meetings law. It really is a little more specific than that. It is limited solely to the executive session provisions of public meetings law. That is that portion of the public meetings law that states specific purposes for which a governing body may convene in an executive or non-open public session. And then thirdly, as Mr. Bender correctly indicated, is the lobbyist registration and reporting requirements, and that's those requirements that a lobbyist register with the commission after reaching so much time or expenditure of money in a calendar quarter in pursuit of lobbying objectives, and that they periodically file reports showing how much they spent in pursuit of the lobbying objectives. And then annually, the entities they represent are also required to file those reports. The commission is currently has four FTE. 2 biennium ago, we had 6.25. We've been able to achieve some internal efficiencies that enabled us to reduce those two and a quarter positions down to the current four that we have, and that would be an executive assistant, two investigators, and myself.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Perhaps, Mr. Riley, did you want to contribute anything at this particular point?
Just briefly. That indicates I am the ultimate lame duck because I think I'm gone. Maybe it was last week. I've been on the commission for 4 years. I can attest to the volume of cases and to the efficiency of staff, and just wholeheartedly support the budget as proposed.
I'm sorry.
That's all I have.
Okay. All right. Okay. Mr. Fraser, would you like to go ahead and proceed on behalf of the Department of Administrative Services?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Dave Fraser from DASH Budget Management. I would like to let the subcommittee know I am certainly at risk with the use of acronyms given my Department of Defense experience, but I would be more than happy to pay the price at the end if somebody would please keep a tally of my transgressions. I'd like to give you just a brief insight into the Government Standards and Practices Commission's budget, the Governor's recommended budget. The Legislative Fiscal Office has also done some work, which will give some additional perspective later. My comments will center around this sheet, Government Standards and Practices Commission, 1999-2001 Governor's recommended budget. The Governor's recommended budget is 23.8% increase from the 1997-99 legislatively approved budget. Half of that increase is a result of increased personal services from selected budget salary increases and general salary PERS increases and general salary package increases. The remaining increase is due to restoring state government service charges reductions and increases for technology upgrades in the policy package. I trace for you the development of the budget starting at the bottom of that first page, starting with the legislatively adopted budget, with the emergency board actions totaled on the top of the back side of the sheet. That emergency board was distribution of statewide salary adjustment dollars provided to the e-board for that purpose. In developing the governor's recommended budget, there were not only standard collective bargaining increases, but there were also selected increases for the investigative classification, of which the government standards and practices has two FTE investigators. Those current service level budget adjustments amounted to $62,652. A sizable increase, but since it was a selective classification increase, those kinds of increases are expected over and above what you would normally expect from collective bargaining. Two essential packages, one class package 010, we actually adjusted for vacancy experience at government standards, and with four FTE, there was absolutely zero vacancies in government standards in the 1997-99 biennium. We anticipated that there would be no vacancies whatsoever. The budget as developed included $7,684 reduction because of anticipated vacancies, and we restored that because of the actual vacancy experience. There was an increase in mass transit taxes of $334. In package 030, standard inflation was $6,004, and increased state government service charges amounted to $27,858. I would say that in that increase, half of that increase was restoring state government service charge reductions that were levied by the last legislature. In other words, we restored the full amount of the budget to government standards so that they'd be able to fully pay the state government service charge assessments that were levied on them. The other approximately $13,000 increase was due to an increase in DASH client service charges, internal support charges. These are charges levied for agencies for which we provide central services for, such as accounting, etc. The one policy package that was approved as part of the governor's recommended budget is package 200 for $32,400. This is a package which we believe will allow government standards and practices to meet the standard expectation for business operations today, which includes email, access to the internet, and a website through which they can disseminate and receive communications from the general public.
Presently, are you year 2000 compliant, Mr. President?
Chair Butler, the hardware that government standards and practices is currently using is not Y2K compliant. And this package will also allow them to purchase new computer software, a server, central server, and allow a little bit for training on the new software.
How old is the existing software or hardware?
Chair Butler, the existing hardware is DX2 66 megahertz computers. I believe they're about four to five years old. Purchased, they weren't current at the time when they were purchased.
So the programs and the hardware are just 4 or 5 years old, bought in the mid-90s, and were not compliant with Y2K?
Chair Butler, the hardware is not compliant, and there were options looked at to either try to upgrade the existing hardware or to buy new computers based on the new state standards in the computer, on contract. Based on the ability of government standards and practices to gain the most flexibility for a period of time, we thought it better to recommend that we buy new hardware today and software that generates their ability to interface effectively with any changes that the state is going through for a much longer period of time.
The one-time cost of $28,000, is that the hardware, and then the remaining portion would be the software?
Chair Butler, the one-time cost, $28,000, includes software procurement, hardware procurement, installation, some training dollars were allowed, and hookup costs to the internet and website development.
Are we using the Information Management Resources Division folks in that software?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are. The cost, or I'm sorry, the estimate to provide those services was done by DAS IRMD, and we have provided that cost estimate to the legislative fiscal analyst.
Senator Trill is recognized.
When somebody is in violation of the rules to the point where you may exact a penalty, is that person entitled to a contested case hearing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trill, yes, they certainly are. If we go through the preliminary review and investigative processes and then get to the point of making what we refer to as a preliminary finding of violation, that takes us to the contested case hearing phase. We are successful, however, at that point in the process in settling about 99% of our cases.
Before you get to there?
Yes, sir. Before we get to a contested case hearing.
Okay. In case you get there, what happens with your ability to do that now because of the legislation that, that may pass the body, which would centralize that activity?
Chair Butler, Senator Troy, I believe you're referring to the legislation that came as a result of the Attorney General opinion on...
No, I'm talking about Shetterly's bill. It's going to be
520. Yeah, right.
I don't know what's happened to that bill. Do you? Anybody know?
Oh. Chair Butler, Senator 2525, the hearings officer bill.
Yeah.
Yes. We're having a real difficult time trying to figure out the impact that that legislation would have.
I don't see it mentioned in your budget one way or the other.
No.
And but if it does pass, do you know what it will do? It will transfer some of what you're doing elsewhere?
Chair Butler, Senator Troy, I don't think it's going to affect our ability to settle cases before that. So I think it would probably change costs a little bit. We don't know yet what the hearings officer costs would be. It would probably do that, but I don't anticipate that it would be a significant change.
How do you deal with it now? If you get a case that goes that far, how do you deal with it?
Chair Butler and Senator Troll, the only cases since 1994 that we've had that have gone to the contested case hearing phase have been de minimis matters or matters involving a failure to timely file a statement of economic interest. The law says that the commission may either appoint a hearings officer or it may conduct the hearing itself. And in those de minimis matters, the commission has conducted the hearing itself.
Would you be excluded from doing that if the legislation passed?
Chair Butler, Senator Troy, I don't believe so. I think that provision is still in the proposed legislation.
Sounds like it's not a very serious problem.
We hope not.
Perhaps what we could do is, just as you go through, if you would, please, the 3 points of the responsibility of the commission relative to enforcement of the conflicts of interest, public meetings violation, and the lobbying regulation, if you would, please, so we can get a sense of what each of those particular areas of responsibility and enforcement would include.
Chair Butler, are you asking for a description of the processes involved in the enforcement of those?
Yes, if I could, please.
Certainly. The majority of the work board does involve alleged violations of RS Chapter 244, Government Standards and Practices Laws. Approximately 95% of the cases we get are the result of the signed complaint of a third party. The enabling legislation also gives the commission the authority to initiate an action on its own motion. An action would be initiated on its own motion through a variety of ways. For instance, information provided by the Audits Division, by the Department of Justice, by a district attorney's office, by a law enforcement agency, and on occasion by a news media story. When the determination is made that the allegation does in fact fall within the statutory jurisdiction of the commission, we provide the named public official and with a copy of the complaint and all supporting material that's come with the complaint. We invite them to provide whatever responsive materials they'd like to. And that is when we now am called the preliminary review phase. And that is confidential. That is the members of the commission and the commission staff are prohibited from making any public comment relating to the case other than to acknowledge that a case is pending and to explain the processes that are involved. That preliminary review has to be determined within 90 days of the filing of the complaint. That is, the commission actually has to act on it within 90 days, which means that the respondent public official probably has in the neighborhood of 45 days to get back to us. Then the staff must prepare its reports and recommendations. We then submit it to the Department of Justice for their review for legal sufficiency, and we submit it to the commission for action at a meeting. Now, as I said, that purpose of the preliminary review is to make a finding of cause to investigate, and cause for those purposes is defined as a substantial, objective basis to believe that a violation may have occurred and that the person to be investigated may have committed a violation. At the conclusion of preliminary review, regardless of whether the matter is dismissed, in other words, there's no finding of cause made, or if there is a finding of cause made, it then becomes publicly disclosable. Now, that doesn't mean that we do a press release and announce to the world that someone is being investigated. It's quite to the contrary. We don't do anything, but if we get inquiries from the public or members of the media, we answer those questions, and they may come and inspect the file if they wish to. That investigation phase has to be completed within 120 days of the finding of cause. So we're looking at a potential total of about 210 days. During that phase, if necessary, we can subpoena documents, we can compel depositions, placing people under oath, although we've never had to do that during my tenure. Most of the time, we find cooperation readily available, and we then prepare another report that, again, is reviewed by the Department of Justice and submitted to the commission, and that report would contain a narrative of the investigative results, a conclusion to be drawn, and a recommendation to the commission as to whether or not the staff believes there is or isn't sufficient evidence to indicate that a violation has occurred.
Director Hearn, so that you can strike fear in the hearts of all of those of us who are politicians here at the table, can you give us, without divulging any specific confidences, can you give us an example of something that, that some of the cases which you've gone through the various issues on relative to the kinds of cases?
Chair Butler, I'll try. The majority of, as Mr. Bender indicated in his preview, the jurisdiction of the commission extends to all public officials of the state of Oregon. And Chapter 244 defines a public official as anyone who serves the state of Oregon or any political subdivision of the state in any capacity, even if they're not compensated for their service. And I find that a pretty interesting definition, and it indicates to me there's a lot of public officials out there. When you figure the 36 counties and the 250-odd cities and the school districts and special districts and the state employees, in fact, it's certainly not unusual for someone to wear the hat of several public officials, state employee, member of city council, and a volunteer firefighter, not at all uncommon. So there are quite a few out there. The majority...
A volunteer firefighter here, a couple of them, volunteer ladies, just got to pay volunteer.
All right.
Smart man.
I was aware of Representative Leonard's profession.
None of us are aware of Representative Trump's profession.
That's the second thing I got from the whole entire department. They've never lost the foundation.
That's commendable.
That's quite correct.
But anyhow, that report was going, Chair Butler, was that the majority of our cases come from the local jurisdictions, I mean, of the 100 school districts or cities or counties or whatever. I would say the most common allegation related to Chapter 244 is inadequate disclosure of a conflict of interest. And in virtually every instance where there is a sustainable violation of an improper disclosure of a conflict of interest arising out of the same action is also going to be a violation of using office for financial gain. It's not necessarily so the other way. You can have the violation of using office for financial gain without a conflict of interest disclosure violation, but normally when there's the disclosure violation, there's the other. It would normally, for instance, if it was a city council, and in fact, I'll use a real example. I happen to live in the city of Staten. We had cases involving the entire council and mayor of Staten last year before us, and a couple of the members were developers. And there was some significant development issues that we knew were hot on the fire at the time. And in virtually every meeting, one or the other or both of actually three developers at one time were on there, would be disclosing conflicts of interest. Now, you notice I use the term disclosing conflicts of interest. I don't use the term declare a conflict of interest, and here's why. The whole purpose in this, and we've researched legislative history to discover this, was to compel disclosure of the nature and the recording of that disclosure. What they were doing in Staten was they would say, I declare a conflict of interest on agenda item 4A, and that was all. That was all that was said. And we weren't sure when we looked at the minutes and saw that that's all that was there. We weren't sure whether there had been an improper disclosure or whether the person recording the minutes simply hadn't recorded a disclosure of the nature. So then we compared the written minutes to the audio recordings, and we discovered that, that in fact there had not been a disclosure made. Now, compliance, so we found them in violation for not disclosing the nature. One of them said, one of the developers, well, it was silly for me to state the reason because everybody in town knows I'm a developer. And that's true, but if you come to research the public record on the project 10 years down the road and there's no disclosure made, that's not going to be known. Compliance could have been achieved another way, rather than even using the words conflict of interest. The responsible, public officials involved could have said, Madam Mayor, I'm not going to participate, or I'm going to abstain on this action because I am the applicant's developer. And that would have complied with the statutory requirements. Those are the most common things. In other instances, it might be a use of office filing. For instance, I recently had an inquiry, just Friday, from the city attorney of a city whose mayor, by virtue of being the mayor, had hosted some Japanese visitors to this city, had taken them sightseeing, et cetera, on two or three occasions. Would not have had that opportunity but for holding the office of mayor. The Japanese visitors, to show their gratitude, sent the mayor a letter and said, we had a wonderful time. We'd like to show you our appreciation. Let us know when you want to come, and we'll send you tickets for you and your wife to come to Japan. He can't accept those. Because, but for holding of the official position or office, he wouldn't have the opportunity to take that trip to Japan. And it was not anything really in his official capacity. It was simply a gratuity from the Japanese visitors. So those are some of the way those statutes apply. One more I might just briefly mention, Chair Butler, is the use of publicly owned resources for personal use. If I'm a public employee, it would be inappropriate and improper for me to take home, if I work for the county, for example, to take home the county backhoe and do some excavation in my yard. Although, very candidly, those things happen and we get inquiries concerning them on a frequent basis. Or using other equipment to pour a new patio, or to borrow the county flatbed truck to go buy a new, pick up a new spa and take it home and set it up. Those kinds of things. In other words, being able to use those resources is not something that's available to the general public. We don't let John Doe walk in off the street and use the backhoe and the flatbed truck. And if we use them to avoid the cost of having to go rent them or to hire someone to do it, then we are accepting, we are availing ourselves of a benefit or a cost avoidance, which is a benefit, that's available to us only by virtue of our holding our office.
Now, if there are any concessions or questions that you'd like to ask on behalf of a friend of a friend, you're welcome to do that.
I have a friend that's a mint farmer.
Yeah. Mr. Sheriff.
Actually, I hold several positions, state legislator, chairman of the local planning commission, and mint farmer, volunteer firefighter. So I have lots of opportunities for conflict. One of the things that is important that we draw a line at in terms of conflict of interest is if an elected official has leftover campaign money, they have it invested in the stock market. How does that implicate their? How does that create problems for them, or does it?
Chair Butler, Representative Krupp, I would respectfully refer you to the Elections Division to answer that question. I have no knowledge of it.
And one more
follow-up, Representative Krupp.
You've been sending out your yearly sheets that elected officials are supposed to fill out and send back to you. And I noticed that other members have gotten them. I haven't seen mine yet and would love to receive it so I can get it back to you at the appropriate timely manner.
Chair Butler, Representative Krupp, as I was telling Senator Lem when he was the first one here, we've gotten several inquiries from legislative offices requesting duplicates. I'll be happy to see that you get them.
Thank you very much.
Of course, I'm tracking the deadline.
deadline is the 15th,
oh,
or not?
Chair Butler, yes.
Okay, just testing. I do have a question. I've got a friend who's a county commissioner, and I better ask
him. An ex-county
commissioner? An ex-county commissioner. I better be careful. I'll visit with you afterwards. I don't know if I want that on the public record.
Yeah.
But this particular area, the conflicts or potential conflicts represent 95% of the work that you do.
Chair Butler, no, I'm sorry, that wasn't what I indicated. What I indicated was that 95% of our complaints are initiated as the result of the signed complaint of a third party.
I see. I beg your pardon. And what percentage of the total energies are used in the government sanctioned practices among the three
areas of jurisdiction?
Yes, sir.
I have one of the handouts that I provided you, Chair Butler, I believe gives some depiction of that. There's one that says, I believe it's the second one you have. It says case filing statistics, and it shows for each calendar year, four shaded vertical bar graphs. The majority is the conflict of interest / ethics violations. The second would be, in most instances, is the executive session provision of public meetings law. That third shaded area, that state FBI, really is part of the ethics component, but we keep it separate because it involves a slightly different workload. And then the small version, the one that is zero in most, is lobbying regulations.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Sir, what does FBI stand for again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, that would be Statement of Economic Interest.
Okay.
Thank you.
What you don't have.
Yes.
And the Statement of Economic Interest, those violations, are they related to just not receiving them, or are they related to improper disclosures on the bus?
Mr. Chair, they're related to them not being filed on time before the statutory deadline, and or not paying the penalty that would follow up. In that regard, Mr. Chair, I might add, because I don't think this is widely known, we don't start imposing any kind of penalty on these until at least 30 days after they're due. And the and then after that period, normally starting on May 16th, legislation permits for a penalty of $5 a day to begin accruing.
I can speak from knowledge on that because I found one filled out and unmailed on the 17th of April, and I drove it to Salem immediately and was told there was no fine for a few days, so it's...
That's usable.
Yeah.
I didn't find mine until the 20th of April. And I sent a $25 check with it, and they wouldn't accept it.
It's a wonderful grace period that we all appreciate.
I have a question in that regard. In regard to the economic interest issue, I guess it's like a prenuptial agreement. You disclose everything you possibly can think of and a little bit more. Would that be a safe statement to start off with on the statement of economic interest? What happens if you don't know if you have economic interest in assets because of blind trust?
Chair Butler, that hasn't arisen during my tenure, but certainly the commission understands the reasonableness of how those things may or may not be known or available. For instance, a question that frequently arises is, there's one on there you'll recall that asks you to disclose any stock you own that's valued at $1,000 or more in the preceding calendar year, and the question is, well, but what happens if I'm in mutuals or or PERS, for crying out loud, owns lots of stock. And my answer to that is, yeah, but you don't own the shares of stock. You own the shares of the fund. So you're not required to disclose that, and likewise with PERS. You don't have any control over that. You may or may not know at any given time what's there. Mr. Chair, I have to fill one of those out, too. I don't understand why. I mean, it takes me 2 minutes. I got my income and my home. But I've compared them to the economic interest disclosure forms from other states and the federal government. These are very, very bland by comparison to many others. Very bland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talk about reporting over $1,000 worth of ownership of stock, is that at the time you're filling out the document, or is it any time during the year?
Chair Butler, Representative Krupp, if at any time during the preceding calendar year.
Okay.
The information is all for the preceding calendar year.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens if you trade a lot of stock? You buy and sell all the time. You have to list all those transactions for the entire year for over $1,000?
Chair Butler, Representative Krupp, as I recall, and I don't have the blank form with me, but I think it requests that you list ownership of any stock worth more than $1,000 during the preceding calendar year. So my response to that would be you would probably have to attach an additional sheet and list them all.
I don't even remember that question. Is there a question on that form that talks about stock?
I don't remember that either. I just filled mine out.
I
don't remember that.
Surely
I thought it was $1,000 you bought property. Property worth more than $1,000. I remember $1,000 special.
Well, I thought it was a business interest, and it seems to me like it's the first or second question, and part of that had to do with stock.
Well, maybe wholly owned corporations that you control. Is that what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't get that specific.
I honestly do not remember the issue dealing with a particular matter of stock. And my heart just sunk because I've done mine year after year.
Mr. Chair, I could be in error, and I'll tell you, I will certainly verify that. But I have a little light saying that goes along with the inclusion of a business interest.
The business interest, the stock and wholly owned or a family-controlled corporation is my recollection. And
that could be it.
And I appreciate that discussion because my heart's been in my stomach for the last couple of minutes. I have no idea that it involved that particular issue.
Those Republicans are worried about the stock deal here.
That's
the problem.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We may have dug ourselves into, and you have it all on record.
Record stating the characteristics. Just kidding. Instead of my financial investment.
Okay. It appears that you have very little lobby issues. 3 years with one particular lobby issue, that's number three, lobby regulations. Does that appear to be any kind of a difficulty there, or is that something that you can anticipate more of in the future?
Mr. Chair, by difficulty, you mean getting them reported, or?
Reports, any problems.
Well, Mr. Chair, the few that we have normally relates to someone being accused of perhaps not being registered on behalf to represent a certain client. Or, for example, we just completed the commission to final action on a case last week involving a lobby issue. In fact, it was the first case that I'm aware of where a penalty has been imposed for a lobbying violation. And it related to a violation of the prohibition against contingency lobbying. That is, the prohibition against lobbying for compensation based on the success of the passage of the legislation. I don't know why there isn't more lobbying violations. I look at other states, and they have them. They have reporting violations. They have violations of the gift restrictions, that is, giving legislators prohibited gifts of a prohibited value, etc. But it doesn't seem to happen much in Oregon, and very honestly, I don't know why, unless it's some kind of an inexplicable cultural thing.
We have the breakdown of the three areas, or the four areas. The executive session appears to have about equal weight over the number of years. I know that from time to time, our council, from a county standpoint, would call the Government Standards and Practices Board and identify, you know, have we done this right? Are we doing it right? Just to make sure. So you must, in that process, you must give out counsel and advice to the public bodies and public entities that we serve in the state. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair Butler, indeed it is. Not only through the course of a telephonic inquiry, such as you're indicating, but in the course of written opinions in response to specific questions concerning circumstances, and then also in providing a training to various public official and public employee groups throughout the state.
Okay. And finally, that of ethics violations, which appears to be the big item there. You have some examples and some horror stories there that we could maybe relate to.
Well, Mr. Chair, the examples that I gave you concerning the failure to disclose the economic interest and the potential trip to Japan, those were two examples of what would be not unusual occurrences in that regard. I didn't have a chance in response to that question you gave me, Mr. Chair, if I may. The investigative procedures and processes are identical for executive session allegations and for the lobbying allegations, so we don't have to go through all that. It's basically the same thing. It would have to be either a complaint filed by a third party or initiated on the motion of a commission. What that means is that in a meeting, a commissioner actually would make a motion and there would be a roll call vote taken as to whether or not that preliminary review should be taken. Executive session violations are an interesting one, and that's, as I indicated it, and I'm sure being a former county commissioner, you know what we're talking about. We talk about executive sessions and the specific authorizations that they have. That legislation was conferred upon the commission in 1993, or the 1993 assembly. It's, ironically enough, it was a bill authored by former Representative Schoon, who is now a member of this commission. But what's happening there, and you see that the workload on executive sessions really is right up there. It's a healthy percentage now of our overall workload. There are school boards there and city councils and special district governing boards who go into an executive session, perhaps for an authorized reason, and then stay in there and discuss other issues that weren't identified as the purpose of the executive session. In other words, these small bodies are trying to do the public's business out of the view of the public, and the public doesn't like it very much. And I think that's one reason why, when they found out there was some enforcement now of those provisions, that it didn't take long for that caseload to rise up.
I think that our county council early on told us that sunshine disinfects, and anything that you can do to be under the sunshine, you probably ought to just absolutely try to do as much as possible, but I know that it is a tremendous temptation to go ahead and discuss a few other things while you're in executive session, and I always felt uneasy when the executive session should have lasted maybe a couple of minutes to just disclose the real salient portions of the items that weren't really public, and yet to go on for a half hour or 45 minutes is a member of the commission would tell war stories or something like that, and that is always most uncomfortable. It's always a difficulty, I'm sure. And so with regard to disclosures and executive sessions and those kinds of things, then that's the majority of what you have relative to ethics violations.
I mentioned one kind of interesting Sheriff Butler. We kind of got to refer to the Supreme Court statement, a judicial case where there was an allegation that the judge had used his office for his own monetary gain. They made that finding by the Supreme Court. One of the allegations was that he was using his state employee without invitation to his golf tournament. And the golf tournament was used for the election campaign. So this is one of the cases where the district, as a matter of fact, is pending right now, where we actually went through the preliminary review of that case. The Supreme Court made a finding that he used his judicial office for his own monetary gain.
Senator Crozier, if you look at the budget, it looks like that from 2 years ago, you have a 30% increase in the budget. To explain why the increase is so much?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crozier, I will, and perhaps Mr. Fazer could even provide some supplementation.
No, it's the hardware.
The primary increases are increased personnel costs as the result of collective bargaining, as Mr. Fazer said.
What? So you only have four people, huh?
Yes.
Okay, so they must have gotten significant increases.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Trow, there were no, in my agency, there were no cost of living increases from 1992 to 1997. And between 1997 and 1999, the increases were pretty significant, as they were throughout the state.
Are you up? Are you back to where you were before with buying power, basically, or are you better off than you were 5 or 6 years ago?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, no, I don't believe that we're back up there. I think we're still behind the eight ball. I mean, I don't have the specific annual cost of living.
You've got two investigators and two officers, right? Do you have any clerical staff?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Trust, not two officers. Actually, the third person outside of the two investigators is an executive assistant who is a combination right hand to me, a secretary, office clerk, does a tremendous job.
All four of you are salaried. You're salaried as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Two investigators, what are their qualifications?
Well, they're both retired police officers with over 20 years' experience, but I believe the generic qualifications for the state's investigative classification include the ability to interview people, obtain evidence, write cohesive, easy-to-understand reports, coherent reports.
In that regard, I have one other question before I want to go to any further detailed issues relative to the budget. The fines pass through to the general fund. Tell me about the fines that you levy and collect and the minimums, maximums that go to the general fund. How much is being contributed to the general fund from the government standards and practices community?
Mr. Chair, I'll give you just a moment. Mr. Chair, through the month of February, as far as penalty revenue goes, from the beginning of the biennium, there had been $16,000 collected and turned over to the general fund. Exactly $16,890.
Just several page one. 15,000.
Mr. Chair, it's $15,889 through February.
And the maximum amount of the fine that you can impose?
The law permits a maximum civil penalty of $1,000 per violation, and if the violation resulted in a monetary gain, in addition to the $1,000 penalty, the commission may impose a forfeiture of up to twice the amount of the gain.
Okay. And finally, I really have to ask this, not because Representative Hansen had the bills today, but there were a couple of bills today, and we have bills that affect our constituents and may affect us. Representative Hansen happens to have a plumber's license and was working on the legislation dealing with boilers and plumbers. When we present legislation as legislators, that might affect us directly or constituents or family members. I think I have one bill on end of the Bar Association on behalf of lawyers and a few of those in the panel. Tell me what kind of hot water I'm in, because those will affect family members if there's an unauthorized practice of law in Eastern Oregon. Hot water would cover your boiler bills. I just needed to know, relative to those kinds of things, those are pieces of legislation which obviously may affect us. From time to time, we'll hear people disclose the fact that they're contractors or that they're licensed plumbing contractors or whatever from the floor. Can you maybe give us some sense of what our obligation is as legislators relative to potential conflicts in that regard?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. There is a provision in the conflict of interest disclosure requirements that's called the class exception. And what the class exception basically says is that if the action taken by a public official financially, I'm paraphrasing, Mr. Chair, financially impacts all members or occupants of a certain profession or all residents of the state or some other class of persons, if the economic impact to the class is to all in the class no greater or lesser degree, a conflict of interest doesn't even arise. So if Representative Hansen is doing something that has a benefit or detriment to all plumbers in the state, no conflict of interest arises. If you do something that has a financial benefit or detriment to all attorneys in the state, no conflict of interest arises. And I do notice sometimes in the record of the floor proceedings that conflicts of interest are disclosed, and they probably don't need to be. But it never hurts to be safe either.
Mr. Senator Trois,
what happens, I guess probably nothing, but I know you're supposed to do that in advance of voting, but what happens if you forget and you just do it later, like maybe 10 minutes later?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Trois, I don't imagine it would be too serious.
Yeah.
I think it's the attempt to comply that's important.
Well, when is it appropriate to do that? When the bill is first heard in a committee or when it's passed on?
Well, Mr. Chair, the statute, when it relates to legislators, says that you have to do it according to the rules of your respective House of membership. So, and I believe, however, that the House and Senate rules are the same. And it says, and the rules say before voting on a bill. Interestingly enough, though, for all other public officials, it would be, for instance, at the moment of introducing the bill.
Right. I know that Representative Hansen has got rather extensive experience as a Multnomah County official, and and making sure that that's done right, and had counsel at hand assisting. But I think that's very important that we know that so that we don't run amok of the system.
Mr. Chair, just one brief comment in response to what you just said, that Chair Riley, who is an attorney and was a municipal judge for over 20 years, shares this too. We have a lot of cases where people are found in violation because of bad advice from counsel. And it is not a defense. And in fact, the Supreme Court, and the only first case that was adjudicated out of the old Ethics Commission, the Supreme Court said asking the attorney basically is asking the wrong guy. You got to ask the commission.
Oh, my goodness gracious. We were always told that if we had counsel from legal counsel legal counsel gave us perhaps not relative to conflict of interest, but to whatever we were doing, that provided some degree of immunity as long as we were acting in good faith. That's not the case.
Mr. Chair, it may be another area. I'm speaking specifically in relation to Chapter 244, Government Standards and Practices.
Come to think of it, it was our attorney that told us that.
Exactly. He told us that. Well, I'm probably going to be looking out from behind the bars one of these days, brethren. Senator Crow is recognized.
Are you in the business really of giving advice up front? People say, I want to know about this. What can I do and what can I do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cho, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, daily we get telephone calls. We get written inquiries. We'll respond in writing. And there's one handout there that will show the changes in our training presentations. I mean, in 1998, I did 48. In 1995, it was only 22. And so far for 1999, I've done 31. So we're trying to get the word out. But it's the old lead the horse to water story sometimes.
What happens in a situation where you're not the only one that looks at the ethics violations? Suppose you have a licensing board, so you have a teacher that's licensed by the TSPC, and they also do that? Who has jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair, Senator Troll, both.
Both.
Yes, sir. We would have jurisdiction for conflict of interest and the use of office violations. The Teacher Standards and Practices Commission would have jurisdiction relative to the licensing of the person.
That would be true of other licensing boards.
Mr. Chair, Senator Troll, yes, definitely.
That would be subject to both.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, Senator Troll, in that regard, I might just mention that it also applies. Oftentimes, we'll find the violations that come before us involve criminal violations, too. And they can both be prosecuted, and there's not double jeopardy.
Thank you very much. I appreciate some very articulate answers to some very good questions. Our charge in the process here is to make sure we balance the budget. That's one of our responsibilities as members of the House of Representatives. And our co-chairs have given us an amount of approximately 4%. We've got to find out of all general fund budgets if we're going to bring a balanced budget to the entire House. I'm wondering Mr. Fisher has had an opportunity to examine. I know that the governor at one point had asked for as much as 10% grant. Mr. Fisher, could you share with us what your potential ideas are there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. We did take a look at the budget for government standards and practices during the budget development for governor's recommended budget. As a result of previous reductions, we did not find that there was a substantial belief that there could be 4% removed from the budget without a much higher probability of the agency having to return either to the e-board for additional resources or, as they had this last biennium, return to DAS to see what other remediating factors or arrangements could be made for them to finish out the 97-99 biennial budget. In addition to the government standards and practices, giving up their fifth FTE for last biennium's budget. As I mentioned, there was a reduction in budget for state government service charge levied by the legislatively adopted budget. However, that didn't make the actual assessments go away, and so we've literally done a juggling act this biennium to help government standards and practices meet their budget objectives. I think that the discussion that just transpired is indicative of a service that government standards and practices needs to have the capability to do, and that is to communicate the finer points of laws and rules and regulations regarding these three areas that we've discussed. In that regard, government standards had put in a policy package asking for a trainer position. In place of that, we actually developed this policy package in their budget, Mr. Chair, for technology upgrades so that these kinds of communications can be available and this assistance can be available to all people in the state of Oregon 24 hours a day via the Internet on a website. In fact, 100% of the questions that were answered today in this hearing are exactly the kinds of questions that you expect to go to a website and find under frequently asked questions. We believe that while it is desirable, and we certainly respect the legislature's position to find a 4% reduction across the board in state government, that it may not be reasonable to assume then that you could take 4% from every single agency budget and still effectively meet the needs of the people in Oregon. So I would say that we did take another look at 4% reductions. I do have a letter here from Pat Hearn, the executive director, to the legislative fiscal office identifying where he would take the 4% reduction should that be levied. And I would suggest that as I look through here, we are talking about infringing on the Government Standards and Practices Commission's ability to leverage their mission objectives, their organizational objectives, if this 4% reduction were to be taken. I would suspect that if the 4% were levied, what we would end up with is mostly a combination of government standards trying to find efficiencies during the course of the biennium, but in effect at the end of the biennium not being able to fully implement the technology needs that are identified in Program Option Package 200.
Relative to 200, Mr. Fager, and I don't want to belabor the point, but relative to 200, is there a possibility that computer system and software could it be leased on a 5-year program? Have we looked at that potential?
Absolutely, Chair Butler, members of the subcommittee. We did look at the ability to actually lease the computers. I'd like to make two statements regarding that. Number one is, typically computer leasing has been related to how quickly the hardware and software become outdated. As we look at the capability of the computers that are coming out now and the sophistication of the software, that cycle is slowing pretty substantially. Therefore, for this particular application, we wouldn't have recommended that they lease, because once you begin leasing, you have to continue leasing. We've identified a substantial amount of one-time costs here. The current computers that are being procured off a state contract for the uses that we've described have substantially greater than a 6-year life easily for those purposes, and so we think that it would be better to go ahead and procure under these circumstances rather than lease. Although, as you point out, leasing could be cheaper in the short run.
I guess the concern that I got is, again, the question that I asked just a few moments ago, and that's relative to the fact that, you know, it wasn't like we didn't know that Y2K wasn't coming, but here we sit, excuse me, with computers as new as any of the computers that I have in my office, and we find out that they're not Y2K compliant, and excuse me, I guess
maybe there's some overriding need for some brand new software, perhaps. Is that what I'm missing? Is there some software here that just has sprung out in the last number of months that we need to beef up the hardware now?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, no, there's not an overriding need to get new software to be able to run on the hardware. It's typical, though, when you do update the computer hardware that you try to achieve state standard for Microsoft's Office Suite, which is generally what's used in the state. And so we would upgrade them to a Windows 95, 98 platform with the latest Office Suite software.
That couldn't be done by modification of the existing hardware in any way, shape, or form.
Mr. Chair, there are, first of all, I might explain that DAS IRMD had looked quite extensively over the past year and a half and believed for quite a while that they would be able to provide a software patch for the Y2K problem. That's one of the reasons we did not support or engender a request for hardware update from Government Standards and Practices last biennium. But in fact, they were expecting a software patch for Y2K. We did look at upgrading the actual hardware. There are bus and motherboard limitations, and since the application of the hardware now entails interfacing across the Internet on a regular basis, we thought that, again, while you may be able to get by cheaper with doing a inexpensive upgrade, the hardware and software system itself wouldn't meet the needs over a longer period of time, and so that in 2 to 4 years we would be back again.
I guess the question I have is probably one that we don't like to ask, but I've asked it time and again. Excuse me, what does it look like, whether it's the State Fair Board or just what does it look like when we do the best that we can with the resources that we have and try and patch it together for 2 years in the interim until we can see whether or not things get a lot better? Is this something, I guess if it's non-Y2K compliant, there's no reason to try and cripple ourselves into the next millennia. Is that your feeling?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's my feeling in particular, and again, to leverage the capability of the agency to meet the needs of everyone in the state, we thought this would be a better approach. I would say that in my experience, if you're looking for an agency administrator who does the most with the least amount of resources, you're looking at him right now. Pat Hearn is an absolute master. He's already spoken about trying to find some potential efficiencies even in the program option package, and I think that you'll find that he is very judicious and exacting in what he invests and spends his money on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I appreciate that testimony. And I don't doubt for a moment that you're 100% accurate, Mr. Sager. I really don't. Mr. Hearn has spoken directly and pointedly to the issue. Senator Coe is recognized.
Looking at this sheet, Mr. Hearn, I know that I see your statement that you don't support any of these cuts. Are those, if let's say we had to make some cuts, are those in any kind of priority order? Or are there some things there that you absolutely would not cut? There are other things, well, if you had to, you would, this kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schull, probably going to take a 2 or 3 part answer. First of all, no, they're not in any priority order. Very honestly, Mr. Bender said the 4% in half percent increments. And when you look through my services and supplies line items, there aren't that many places where you can take that much. It's just not there. So basically, that's why I went to these categories that are reflected on this memo of last Friday. And I mean, the smallest increment is $3,500 and the others are $7,000 because that's just where it was.
I suppose if I was going to put them in order of priority from easiest to lose to the hardest to lose, I might put office expenses. I probably would just switch office expenses and in-state travel, and I think the rest would remain just about the same.
So office expenses would be the easiest to tap if we had to tap some, and in-state travel would be the next of it.
Mr. Chair, that's essentially what I'm saying, but I'd like to qualify that by saying that in the office expenses category, we already are pretty judicious and bare bones in how we buy it. Sometimes it amazes me when my office person orders supplies and I approve the bill and how minimal they are. But you know, it's just to the basics that you need: the pens, the pencils, the paper clips. The in-state travel is a little different. What reducing in-state travel would do would limit our ability to go about the state and provide training to public officials. And basically that's just, that's mostly mileage and some occasional lodging and meals.
I'm wondering if that could be done more and more with the EdNet2 and those kinds of things, if locally officials could participate in that fashion.
Mr. Chair, I think if they had the facilities to receive it and participate on their end, I think it probably could be to a degree.
I think we're seeing that more and more. We had meetings from that were conducted by Kitty Piercy and Representative Piercy in the House recently, and Adrian Crane, Burns, Vail, Ontario, various areas of the state, which were done here in the Capitol. We initiated that system just within the last couple of weeks to start off with person-to-person discussions through the use of the internet, and it isn't inexpensive, and it isn't as easy to get by with as direct one-on-one and those kinds of things. Other questions come from quite a distance here. We'll take up tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we'll come back and I'll work with my co-chairs and see what their feeling and tolerance is for some latitude that they may be able to give us. You may do if I get too far out of hand, expressing gratitude on behalf of the subcommittee. We do appreciate your being here and recognize that probably as much a labor of love, recognizing for years we were behind the eight ball as to the increases. Mr. Riling, we appreciate your years of service as well, and appreciate your being here even when you're in the process of retiring. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and turn ourselves 1 o'clock tomorrow. Thank you.